Welcome back to the AEC Disruptors Podcast, your platform to help push the AEC industry forward. I'm your host, Christopher Dell, and joining me today is my co-host, Jackson Sinsat. Welcome, Jackson.
How are you doing, Christopher?
Pretty good, man. Pretty good. I got to ask you, have you ever been to Chicago?
You know, I've been there on a connecting flight, and I had some wonderful airport food there.
Highly never outside recommend. The airport.
Never outside the airport, unfortunately.
When I went and visited, only once, and this was before the world was weird, I stood in front of Lake Michigan, and I was floored by how big, I thought it was an ocean. It was the biggest I've ever seen. And, you know, that seems like a weird way to start a podcast, but today's guest, Keith Besserud, he's the director of innovation at Gresham Smith. He was actually, when we interviewed, he went to his office. He was one of those brave people that went to the office. And I asked him, I was like, you know, why are you in the office? And he showed me out his window, had a fantastic view of Lake Michigan. So I think that's why he went. Or he just wanted to show me out the window. I'm not sure why. All right. So today we had I had the chance to talk to Keith, and a lot of our conversation really was about just innovation as a process, or developing it as a process, and how, you know, we here at Applied, we're in the beginning of this journey. Keith has had a storied career, but he had some great ideas and thoughts as to how to approach innovation. Yeah, one of the key takeaways I had, at least, was some of the mentality he brought from the startup world, you know. So Jackson, I know you had a chance to hear it and listen in. What were your thoughts on some of his high-arching points?
I think that, first of all, this was one of the most impressive people I've ever listened to in my life. Whenever he was talking about startups and just innovation in general, I think his best point was to not be in your own silo. Because, you know, you could think that you have the best idea ever, and, you know, you could just keep working on it and working on it and not really telling anybody about it, you know, trying to be real cutesy with it. Like, it's a surprise. And when I drop this, it's going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. But really, the mentality needs to be, like Keith said, you know, you need to put some half-baked stuff out there and get some feedback on it. Because at the end of the day, you know, we're in this business to make money. Mm-hmm. And although you make a really cool thing that you love, not everybody's going to love it. And you need to have feedback from the people who are going to be using it down the road. So I think his point of putting the half-baked ideas out there for feedback is really important, and it's necessary for innovation.
I thought that was a great takeaway, because the kind of like the get outside the building concept. And even I think he mentioned, like, you might have a great idea and you might be working on something, but it doesn't get used the way you intended it. It still could be successful. I mean, there's a ton of products out there just that we all probably interact with, or, you know, we were joking about our hats and stuff, but like Rogaine, I think, is an example of one that wasn't intended to be a hair product. You know, it was intended, I think, to be a heart medicine or something else.
And just blew my mind.
Yeah, no, I think it may not have been a heart medicine. It was a real thing. So, you know, that idea of that, getting outside the building, sort of testing your theory as to what you're doing is the right answer, is the right thing. I think that was a great thing. Another takeaway I had was, it seems simple, but they've committed at Gresham Smith. They really committed from the top down as to this innovation. They even talk about they instilled it as one of their pillars of an organization, but they had a line item for a budget. And it seems like it's, you know, that's a very corporate thing to have to do. But when you take that off the table, it really helps open the doors to what we can achieve.
Right. And another thing that Keith said is that, you know, ingrained in their innovation culture is that failure is okay. And that's a big thing, because, you know, some people, you know, they'll have an idea and they'll work on it and they'll think it's awesome. But there's also going to be people who are scared to put their idea out there for whatever reason. You know, their coworkers might think that, you know, differently of them for that idea or yep. whatever, and they're scared to put it out. They don't have the conviction behind that idea. But whenever you ingrain in the culture that, you know, hey, it's okay to fail. It's okay to bring things up that, you know, we may not go for. That's going to allow you to have a much larger net of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be diamonds in the rough whenever, you know, you have a culture like that, whenever you're trying to achieve innovation at your company.
He really has created a safe space to innovate, which I think is something that I took away and want to instill. Like I said, like you said, he was a great person to interview. I'm sure we will have him back on, and he had a lot of great things to say.
So yeah, I'm an architect, by school and by license, practiced, you know, maybe the first part of my career in sort of a traditional kind of way. I mean, I go back far enough that my first jobs were hand drafting. So I sort of have been able to live the transition.
Hey, I have a drafting board.
Yeah, I see that. So when technology emerged, I was very interested in it, and throughout my career as a designer, I had always been interested in how technology was potentially enabling things as a designer that weren't possible before. So I was always intrigued with that. And mid-career, I ended up taking a break. I was living in the New York area, in Hoboken, New Jersey, and I happened to be there at a time when a program was born at a place called the Stevens Institute of Technology, by a fellow named John Nastasi, who had came out of Harvard GSD. And he set up this interdisciplinary program at Stevens that was bringing together design and technology, and design not just from architecture, but from you name it kinds of design, from medical, engineering, aeronautical. It was kind of open to anybody, but the common denominator was the technology that was emerging. And so I resigned from the job that I had to go back to school mid-career to get this 2-year degree. And while I was there, the New York office of SOM started sponsoring research. And I was part of the first cohort that was interfacing with their design teams, bringing things like genetic algorithms and, you know, other kinds of things to their work. And this was in 2006 ish. And so when I finished the program and had developed this relationship with SOM, they recruited me and a couple other people. And I set up a team in the Chicago office called Black Box. And we ran that for about 7-8 years. It was a prototype, sort of technology consulting, internal consulting team, I guess you could say, you know, and facing. The important part about that was it was totally internally facing. We didn't face clients at all. We were supporting design teams and so forth. So I did that for several years. And then after that, went on to Gensler, was part of their data and analytics group. And that one did have more of a client facing orientation. And so with Black Box, especially at the start, the whole industry was sort of more focused on parametric, you know, mm-hmm. modeling, parametric design, parametric thinking, and so forth. Parametric tools were emerging, and that's kind of where the large part of the focus. By the time I moved on to Gensler, the focus had started to shift to data more explicitly. And so I was part of a team there that was looking at things. And like I said, there we started looking at ideas about how can we use data and analytics to expand our services to clients. How can we change, you know, some of the things that we do? How can we help them understand their projects, even pre-design from a more strategic position, mm-hmm. you know. So one of the things that we got into was spatial analytics, understanding space utilization, and starting to think about user experience in the built environment a little bit. And through that kind of line of inquiry, I got to know a fellow that had been getting a startup off the ground here in Chicago, And he was using computer vision technology to understand utilization patterns. So counting people, measuring wait times, things like that. And I was intrigued with it enough that I thought, you know what, I'm gonna go get a taste of the startup world. And so I ended up partnering with him and co-founding a company called SpaceBot and got familiar with the world of startups, which was a huge shift for me. You know, having worked, used to drawing a paycheck every 2 weeks and, you know, having teams around me and all that kind of stuff. And it was just me and my partner, Dave Turner. So, but what was really exciting about it, what I really enjoyed about it, was the direct interface with clients and the ability to hear, you know, straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak, what they, you know, what they were interested in, what they would pay for, what they weren't interested in. Because one of the things I know within my experience working within firms, both at SOM and in Gensler, and working with, you know, the kinds of people maybe that Randy Deutsch refers to as super users, that there can be a sort of a self-destructive tendency to isolate yourself when you're developing something. And what I mean by that is, you know, an inspired individual, a talented individual gets an idea for some tool or some method or something that they want to develop. They know how to do it and they just go to town doing it. They build this tool. They think it's the best thing ever. They put it out there and then nobody uses it.
Yep. Do it all in a silo.
Yeah. And so this idea of engaging with your market, even if, you know, whether that market is the teams in your firm around you, the other architects and designers or whatever, or whether it's an external client, you know, outside that represents an actual new business opportunity. This idea of engaging with the client is something that we're not typically trained to do. I think we're more inspired by making than we are by turning it into a business. And there's a huge difference between having a great idea and turning that into a business.
It's like being an entrepreneur versus an inventor.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
And master tinkerer.
Yeah, that's true. And so those are the kinds of things I've become a little bit more attuned to, I think, mm-hmm. having spent time in the startup world. And so I spent a year there, you know, spent all my money trying to get an idea off the ground with my partner and just finally had to cry uncle and say, Dave, I gotta get back to earning a paycheck.
Yep.
And so he's still pushing the company along. I've moved back into the corporate world, and now I'm with Gresham Smith, where I'm the director of innovation and leading the charge to sort of supercharge the innovation culture here, let's say. So
quite the story background. So because I guess this ties into your conversation earlier you mentioned. Were there some key takeaways from your startup years that you've now tried to infuse into the corporate world? Or, I mean, in a way, every business was a startup, right?
Right.
At some point, what happens to the big corporate giants? You know, why does that methodology change from the beginning?
Yeah, I think for me, one of the biggest takeaways was, you know, like I had mentioned about the idea of getting in front of your clients and in startups, you know, it's not unusual to hear people talking about the concept of pivoting. Mm-hmm. How you come up with an idea, you may be so in love with this idea and you think it's just the greatest thing and you really want to make it. But if you start listening to the market, there's a good chance that the market might start telling you you're not quite thinking about this right, or you may want to think about using this in a different way because that's where a real market is. And you have to sort of let go of your sort of this idea that you've sort of saturated in your head about where this should end up, you know, how this story should end and you know, where it's going to lead to. And you can't do that in a startup. You've got to be attuned to what the market is telling you somehow. And mm-hmm. So here at Gresham Smith with the incubator that we're, you know, in the process of developing, that's one of the basic principles that I'm trying to embed as we start to, you know, green light some projects here is looking at a work plan that identifies, you know, all the points in the process where you're taking your ideas, you know, out to the floor to, you know, your teammates or whoever it is that's going to be using it, or to a client of ours outside of the office, and getting feedback. Yep. Getting these feedback cycles are so important. And if you listen to them, you're going to have, you know, a much better chance of success. So
I don't remember where I saw this or who coined it, but I keep reading, like, get outside the building. Uh-huh. Go outside the building, you know, and it speaks to the, if we do everything in a silo, we lose sight of like what the customer actually needed or wanted.
Right. And
we do get so attached to like, it has to work this way. No, you don't understand. It has to work this way. And so I've tried to, at least in concept, keep that, you know, close to heart of get outside the building, ask your people, you know, ask your customers, ask people on the street, you know, what is it that you need or want or have to do?
Right.
So you started talking about the incubator. You mentioned that. Now, I know there's a lot going on around that. Before we even get there, when you started with Gresham Smith, did you create a whole new innovation process, set it up? Had they already started? I mean, obviously Gresham Smith's been around for quite a while. I mean, did they already kind of have a methodology they were trying to apply? And really, what was the charge as to why we needed to go this direction?
Yeah, it was interesting. When I came on board, I was hired largely through the design arm of the firm. The design director, Jeff Koonin, was my primary point of contact as we were going through the, you know, the in interviewing and then the onboarding processes. And the role at that point, I think, had sort of more of a digital, let's call it digital design orientation, you know, which was about sort of elevating design practices and you know, processes and tools and all that kind of stuff, sort of changing the design culture, you know, through technology. While I was coming on board, the chief strategy officer in the company, Randy Gibson, was also spearheading a broader innovation initiative across the firm. And as things were moving forward, it was becoming apparent there was more and more overlap between the agenda that I was driving more narrowly around digital innovation and the broader agenda that Randy was driving around innovation, period. And sort of recognizing that the vast majority, not all of it, but the vast majority of innovation right now has a digital grounding in some way.
Yep.
And so that sort of led to merging the two initiatives, basically, and I, you know, ended up being put in the position to lead it. And so one of the things that we in fact, just structurally within the entire company, we sort of reorganized what we called our corporate pillars to have three pillars. That one is about design excellence, one is about essentially delivery excellence, and then the third is innovation. So one of the three primary pillars of the entire company was identified as innovation. So it got that sort of recognition and blessing. You know, the messaging around the importance of innovation was sort of embodied in this idea that we've established it as one of our three primary pillars. And so within this innovation pillar now, we've set up what we call Studio X, which is an incubation platform, let's call it. And we also, our second sort of main vehicle that we're standing up is something we're calling Knowledge Labs, which is sort of more of a lightweight research kind of arm, which is focused on information gathering. So we've got seven key areas of disruption that we've identified within the industry and within our clients' industries. And each of those seven has a team that's focused on information development and understanding what's going on in the world right now in these sectors. And what does that mean to Gresham Smith, and how should that potentially impact our strategy around business and so forth?
How did you guys land on the seven? Like, did you have like an initiative to seek out what, where the industry is going, or
it happened sort of just organically, I'd say. It wasn't highly structured process. The seven categories are advanced construction and fabrication, advanced materials and systems, AR, VR, XR, data intelligence, digital twins, human experience, sustainability and resilience. So they're all, you know, sort of some of the usual suspects that everybody's talking about. And for whatever reasons, we've settled on those. There's others, I suppose, that could be candidate ideas. But anyway, for now, that's what we've got. And each of those has a team that's tasked, you know, a small team of four people that are tasked with going out there and finding out what's going on and then developing communication strategies to share that out with the entire firm.
I think those are good four or a good seven. It's interesting because, you know, I came up with a similar list for something else. Huh. And a lot of those topics are pretty, not old, but older topics.
Right.
That I don't know if the industry has like lost sight of it or they got distracted or, you know, what it is, but all of these older topics like digital twins, that's been around for a long time, or sustainability,
right.
which,
right.
you know, depending on your opinion, is a big deal or not. But it's now reaching a point where it's everywhere. Everyone's talking about it. And I don't know if it's, you know, the current times or what, right. but it seems like it's more prevalent now.
Right. Yeah. And it's, you know, I think there's some, you know, Gartner has that hype cycle, you know, diagram, that curve that I think is, it's a pretty good curve, I think, you know, where there's that, you know, that initial hype, you know, that goes into it and, you know, these, you know, heightened expectations and then the trough of despair or whatever it's called when people get tired about hearing about it because they're not really seeing anything coming of it. And then it finally reaches, you know, a rebound point and gets to a sustainable development, you know, level of interest and things are happening. And, you know, I'm not sure where all seven of these are. You know, there's different things within each of those seven that fall in that different locations on that curve. But I agree. There's a lot in here that, especially if you've been sort of immersed in the digital, you know, technology aspect of practice, you especially have been hearing about these things for a long time. And maybe people that are outside of that bubble, you know, haven't been hearing. In fact, we had, I'm heading up the Digital Twins group within Knowledge Labs, and we had our first call earlier this week and with the team. And we've deliberately seeded the teams with diverse people from different disciplines and different market groups within the company. And so I didn't know three of the four people on my team. And we, you know, had a conversation about, you know, what this is about. And I asked everybody, I said, how many of you are actually familiar with the term digital twins? And one of the people has said they had never heard of the term before. It's a mixed bag right now. So we're trying to, you know, through this part of our innovation pillar anyway, trying to get our arms around all of these moving fluid concepts that are, you know, swashing around outside in the world. So that's,
I appreciate that you guys, like, I appreciate sort of management or leadership sort of setting it as a direction, a pillar of your organization, because in a way, like, I think innovation can be kind of perceived as a little gimmicky, like, oh yeah, we're all innovative, or oh yeah, we need to innovate. But to actually have the backing and say, no, you know, this is why we need to do it, and this is what we're going to achieve out of this.
Right.
It seems like I've had several of these conversations up to this point, and it all the ones that have been successful, it was with the backing from the top that, you know, this is a direction that we want to go in.
Right. Yeah. And it's, of course, it's not just rhetoric, you know, that the question is, you know, is there money behind it? Is there line items in the annual budget that cover the cost of actually doing what, you know, everybody says you want to do. And I feel like we're fortunate here because the leadership in the company, the C-suite, you know, has endorsed this, and we have an annual operating budget for innovation, which is not quite seven figures, but it's a pretty nice chunk of money.
And that's huge, because in a way that takes that off the table. So now you don't have to worry about, you know, the money part. You can focus on the things that actually, after you've prioritized your list, that are going to, you know, have the biggest return.
Yeah. So with Studio X, you know, so Knowledge Labs is kind of our, as I said, sort of lightweight research, I would call it. We're not developing things, but in Studio X is where, you know, the intent is to develop things. Although in this first year, we've got kind of a mixed bag of things that are more lightweight. So we've got a group that is looking at, you know, the advanced construction techniques, what's going on out there and what does that mean? So we actually did fund through Studio X a specific project for that. couple others like that. But then we've also got some that are much more, you know, the end product is going to be some kind of software development work. And so it's a bit of a mixed bag. And we're going through the process now of sort of formalizing the work plans for each of those so that there's an understanding of both scope and schedule and deliverables and treating them like real projects. And, mm-hmm. You know, and having a number of checkpoints along the way where we can always take a look and see, okay, how's this going? You know, are we throwing good money after bad money, or is this actually, you know, looking like it's moving in a promising direction, and we can, you know, cut or keep fishing if we want, you know, so.
How did you land on sort of the need for that type of incubator platform? What was the driver for even the creation of Studio X?
I think there's a number of things. I think part of it is sort of, you know, sort of this, there's this vague idea, you know, of our industry being under siege in a way, right? That there's all kinds of things happening outside of our
disruption.
Industry. Yeah. And, you know, how do we prepare for that? And maybe, you know, sort of the answer is you need innovation as a core, you know, core concept within your company. And how do you make that happen? Well, you've got to engage people. You've got to let innovative people innovate. And, you know, how do you do that within the framework of, you know, a company that needs to continue operating, and we still have, you know, margins we need to hit, and you know, the whole issue of chargeability and what we
utilization
call utilization rate, you know, is always, you know, in front of everybody, and so how do you create a safe space where innovation can actually happen, where project managers aren't freaking out because you're burning hours on something and they're not seeing the value of it yet, and you know, that whole dynamic. So you know, it's an attempt to create that safe space, and part of what I think I bring from having spent time in the world of startups is how do you bring a startup or certain parts of a startup mentality into that corporate environment to you know, get a little bit past the whole fear, you know, the risk mitigation mentality that drives it's the whole reason why we have, you know, you know, legal counsel on staff, you know,
yep.
to sort of, you know, keep us in bounds, so to speak.
And so much, well, I don't know if it's true, but it seems like so much of innovation, in a way, it's a game of failure. It's like my favorite sport is baseball, which is clearly a game of failure. You yep. know, like a 300 batting average is Hall of Fame, but you failed seven times. Right. And so I've came across a quote long ago that I actually really liked, and it was something along the lines of, you can't encourage innovation and punish failure.
Yeah.
And it is something that it sounds like, you know, you have to, it has to be ingrained in the culture, because we are constantly fighting the, well, what is the ROI on this? Have right. I evaluated the assessment? Oh, we worked on this for 20 hours. And at the end of 20 hours, we decided we didn't want to work another hour.
Yeah.
Sometimes, and again, we're in the beginning of it, but we've gone through trying to adopt some lean principles in our innovation. And we would do essentially a lean canvas or a business model canvas on an idea. And the thought is it tries to get some of those individuals to think outside the building a little bit.
Right.
But I told them that, you know, not every idea may do it, but if we did, we'd develop it through that level. And then at the end of it, we just need, you know, what is the ask? The ask could be, we don't need to pursue this anymore. And yeah. that is totally acceptable. Right. The ask could be, I need a $10,000 or $100,000, and that's fine too. But recognizing that, you know, all the things we're battling, not everything we do is going to work. So the question right. then is, I mean, everything that has gone through Studio X or that you push, I mean, do you all have kind of like a moment where you assess and say, is this worth pursuing? Or have you already done that before it even gets to Studio X?
Well, when we put out a call for ideas across the firm shortly after the first of the year, and, you know, being the first time doing this, we had no idea what the response would be, and you know, crossing our fingers that we would get responses, and we ended up getting 99 responses, almost 100 responses. And
tell me one person couldn't have sent another one. You couldn't have gotten clear 100.
Right. So then obviously we went through a vetting exercise of evaluating all the the ideas, and that was a fairly informal process. We didn't have hard guardrails on. But what ended up happening is a majority of the selections ended up sort of aligning with the categories we had identified, for example, in our knowledge labs. So we got a good deal of coverage across that spectrum of project ideas.
And did they know that before? Like, when you did the call for ideas, did they also know the seven?
No, they didn't. And that's, you know, one of the things, you know, we're learning as we go. And so I think next year we'll be a little more explicit about, you know, hopefully identifying the criteria by which we're going to evaluate. You know, we didn't really have that sense of criteria in place for this first time. Like I said, we wanted to cast a wide net because we weren't sure what kind of response we would get. So mm-hmm. we put very little out there in terms of expectations about what the projects would be. And we got a really wide variety. We got, you know, of course, a number of sort of digital technology oriented ideas. But we got a lot of things that were like, you know, somebody said, somebody suggested that we stand up a new company that was founded by that was staffed by veterans, and it was you know, to position that as a different kind of business unit and so forth. And so there was a lot of different kind of thinking that was going on around propositions because we hadn't put any guardrails on. So you know, there was this process of saying, you know, that as we were evaluating that, said, okay, this one really just needs to be steered to HR, or this one needs to be steered to the C-suite. It's not really a Studio X project, but it's a really good idea. And sort of had some of that kind of exercise going on, which I thought was really good.
How did you, so you said like you didn't set out your guardrails, but when you went through that review process, because I would say that I believe, or at least I've encountered, is one of the harder parts, is that evaluating and prioritizing, because in a way everything seems like a good idea.
Yeah.
So, you know, without having all of that background yet, how did you guys determine which route you wanted to go?
It was, I mean, honestly, it was just a lot of discussion, you know, talking through ideas, and it was highly imperfect. I would say, you know, I think in the end we got a mixed bag of things that were low hanging fruit, some that were more sort of lightweight research, like I said, mm-hmm. and then some that were potential home runs, you know, one or two that, you know, had some real profound potential, I think. So yeah, it was kind of, we ended up sort of gravitating, I think, in that way, you know, towards the final selections, and then, you know, kind of trying to weigh all of that against what we, you know, understood to be our budget and what we perceived might be the weight of the lift for each of those projects mm-hmm. potentially. So once those seven were selected, then we went into this process of basically for each one, getting real clear about scope, because the process for submitting an idea was a one-page form. We wanted to make it very painless. So there wasn't a lot of elaboration about the idea. We weren't asking people to develop business plans or labor estimates or cost estimates or anything like that with their idea yet. We just wanted to know what the basic idea was, what the problem was that they were addressing that, you know, led to them to make this proposal. Mm-hmm. So once they were accepted, then we began the exercise of saying, okay, let's talk about the scope of this. Let's talk about what all you're going to really need in terms of how much of your time. Are we going to need to hire outside developers to write code? Are we going to need to find outside subject matter expertise to weigh in on, you know, how this should be developed, and, you know, all those kinds of things to arrive at some order of magnitude understanding of the cost, reconciling that against the overall Studio X budget. And then where we are right now is an exercise of having, in some cases, to say, okay, we're going to have to cut some scope here, or we're going to have to define this as a multi-phase project that only phase one is in fiscal year 20, and maybe a subsequent phase is going to have to get evaluated for FY21, and, you know, those sorts of things. So that's kind of where we're at right now.
The AEC Disruptors podcast is brought to you by Applied Software. With solutions for the modern project, Applied Software is on a mission to transform industries by empowering clients and champion innovation with real-world expert consultants. Their comprehensive array of solutions for the AEC, MEP, and manufacturing has a singular focus, helping you achieve higher performance. With software, training, support, consulting, and custom development, Applied Software has you covered. Visit ASTI.com and let them know we sent you.
You guys, you recently won an award, right? You mentioned that to me.
Yeah.
So, and that came out of Studio X?
No, not actually. It was a case where we had a motivated individual, had been doing some development work of his own, even outside of the office, on an idea about harvesting heart rate data that could be interpreted into stress that we could begin to equate with locations in the built environment. So trying to understand the emotional experience of different locations in the built environment. And so he submitted that idea to Studio X. You know, it was at a certain level of development, and he submitted it to Studio X for additional development. We ended up accepting that idea into Studio X. And in the meantime, prepared an awards submission package for Architect Magazine for their annual R&D awards program. And we ended up getting awarded last month on that project. So we picked up one of the 7 awards for this year's cohort.
That's exciting. Congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. So now with Studio X, you know, we have this opportunity to take a project that I think has got a lot of potential. It's gotten some visibility now, and you know, looking to move that forward. And it's also forcing us to quickly grapple with, you know, understanding, okay, patents and IP. You know, do we need to sort of start formalizing engagement in those kinds of constructs? What is going to be our corporate policy around IP on these ideas?
Ownership.
When we solicit this from people in the firm, you know, how do we incentivize them to come forward with their idea, as opposed to them saying, you know, I just want to do this on my own outside of the company. And
I'll be curious to see what you guys come up with for that. Cause that actually is a specific conversation I had internally with someone, because it's a difficult thing. Like, if, you know, I was at Georgia Tech, and you know, I think their stance is, while you're there, anything you do within the confines, in a way, they own. So right. It's like, okay, well, are we going to miss out on some really great ideas because right. of our stances? If I develop it on company time, I own it. And that's a pretty common stance, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I would be curious if that's the right stance. Because in a way, you're going to cut yourself short, because somebody's going to say, well, I have a fantastic idea, and I'm going to, on right. Saturday, submit this to get a patent, and you would have never known about it.
Right. Yeah. And you know, that policy that you describe at Georgia Tech is very common, I think, in all universities. And yep. It's actually very common in the corporate world. Every company I've worked for, I've signed a form, and but when I came on board, that basically said, any idea I come up with at any time, you know, at work or not, is the property of the company. And, mm-hmm. And I understand where that boilerplate comes from. You know, our legal groups within the company, their mission is to protect the company, to, yep. Protect their investments in the development of ideas and so forth. But it's a very one-sided, kind of mentality. And when you make the, you know, the declaration that as a company, you're going to prioritize innovation, you've got to think about how do you temper that kind of those kind of protections that are in place, so that you don't, you know, shoot yourself in the foot with trying to get innovation off the ground. So,
I mean, there's been stuff I've worked on in a past life. Now, I didn't chase a patent or anything. At the time, I thought maybe I would, that I stopped at a certain point, and I'm like, ooh, this is a pretty good idea. You know, I'm going to work on this later.
Right.
And, you know, start using my own home computer and doing it on the weekend. And in a way, it's like, granted, that went nowhere, but there is that mentality of like, there could be a world in which both the organization and the employee could benefit the same amount.
Right.
Whereas right now, no one's going to benefit, because it's going to either be the employee doesn't get what they deserve, or the company's not going to get the idea. So the lose-lose, I think.
Yeah. So yeah, that's something that we're working through now. And, you know, I can imagine it may be some baby steps, but I think that, you know, I mean, when you look at corporate America, or the corporate world for that matter in general, there's, you know, historically, I feel like there's been this sort of movement away from the once upon a time when loyalty was a core bedrock concept on both sides. You know, the companies were extremely loyal to the employees. The employees were extremely loyal. I mean, my dad worked for one company his entire career. You don't see that much anymore.
No. And now, like, you hear in a way the argument of, oh, that's not good, because you don't get new, you know, points or view or perspectives. And, you know, I hear it all the time, because I was in a meeting a couple of weeks ago, which I fall into the millennial group, and they just like said, oh, they only stay in your company for 3 years. So enjoy the next year. And so it kind of goes both ways. You look at LinkedIn and somebody would say, oh, they've been in a lot of places less than 2 years. Well, that could be a positive, right? It could be, you know, so loyalty. Right. Yeah. It doesn't exist anymore, I don't think.
Yeah. And so that kind of claim, you know, of owning, you know, every thought that comes out of your brain. And even in this sort of emerging, you know, this climate of diversity and inclusion and social justice and social equity. And it sort of doesn't resonate quite right, especially as what's happening. It has a feeling of you know, almost a colonial kind of mentality that we own everything about you. And, there's at some point that's going to be counterproductive, I think. And so, you know, but at the same time, you know, the company does have to protect their investments. And, and if the company doesn't exist, then nobody wins, you know, so.
And they're paying balance, you to think about those things in a way.
So if you can incentivize people to you know, bring those ideas forward and turn it into a win-win, I think that's what we're searching for as we're developing, you know, the Studio X platform here. So
as we start to kind of wrap up, you know, we talked a little bit about your startup experiences. And then is there anything, you know, we sort of touched on it, but is there like one or two core things that you try to instill now that you think are ingrained in the startup world? To help specifically around innovation, because I think that's where the biggest drive would be.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I think, I mean, this is coming from, you know, you mentioned, I think, Agile and you know, concepts like that I think, you know, have come from, the, you know, the software development world and, you know, are trying to be folded into practice. And this idea of, again, I see this a lot with designers is, you know, that are, you know, also developers, you know, the desire to take something to a finished, polished state, and then put it out there for people to consume, risking, you know, as I said before, the possibility that it just may not ring true with people, you know, even though you think it's perfect. And so, you know, the idea of putting stuff out there that's half baked, that's still dirty, that's still messy, that's you know, just to be able to get feedback, I think is one of the things that I feel like we have to explicitly focus on still, because of that tendency to want to take it to a polished state before you share it. I think that's something fundamental that we're working on. So, you know, working with prototyping tools like Adobe's XD, and we've got somebody that likes a product called Proto.io, just to quickly mock things up. Both, and we're using these tools on the Studio X project, not only to sort of share the ideas with other potential users, but even before that, to share it internally with our project management, you know, groups to understand what are you thinking about how this tool is going to work. And by making people just visually mock it up first, you start thinking about, okay, how is this going to work? You know, and when they click on this, what's going to happen? And where's all the data going when you do click on it, and what happens, blah, blah, blah. So you think it enables the ability to think through the scope very explicitly and get everybody on the same page very quickly about where this tool is headed and how it needs to work. That's another thing I see, this idea. And, you know, it's sort of surprising to me in a way, because architects, when we're doing architecture, this is exactly how we work, right? We create quick concepts.
Yep.
We have a phase called conceptual design. We take it to a certain level. We share it out. We get immediate feedback before we've invested in, you know, engineering the whole idea and all that kind of stuff. And we move it along. We move it along incrementally and get feedback at every step before we go to the next step. But for some reason, the people doing, you know, digital development, you know, don't, you know, maybe I don't know what it is, but it doesn't by nature tend to progress that way.
I don't know. I do find it interesting because I would say that, you know, as architects, we're not the best business people. But this, if we took the concepts that we use in design and apply those same concepts to business, I think we'd be a lot better off. And with the innovation, one thing I found interesting is there's stuff that's come out of it in a way, at least internally, that it makes us start to reflect on how we do other things in the organization. It may not be a world changing idea or anything. I mean, it could be something as simple as I was messing with Power Automate to do some stuff for myself because I, you know, was being lazy. And then I'm like, wait a second, what if we do this over here? And you know, for accounting. So
and that's,
I like
that's
having
true.
A forum to do it.
And I'm finding even, you know, just by like we recently hired somebody that came out of the University of North Carolina. They have an interesting program there. It's a dual degree architecture and IT master's program. And so we hired a fellow out of there recently and he's been doing some automation stuff around for people around the firm. And it has been interesting to see exactly that in a way from our internal team, but from people, you know, out in the studios, out on the teams saying, wow, I didn't know you could automate that. And then a light bulb goes off and they say, well, does that mean you could also automate this and this and this? And, and you start getting people to actually become conscious of, you know, a little bit of what's possible.
That's the beauty. Cause like I do a lot of Dynamo with Revit and you know, I would show people that are never going to use it, but I would just show them the process of something. And then I would say, okay, now go, you know, go think. Cause now that, you know, I can automate the creation of a sheet. Yep. Now you're going to ask me, well, can I do this? Right. What about that? Yeah, of course we can.
And that's an important aspect of trying to cultivate innovation, I think, is just for people to realize that there's things that can be done that they hadn't even thought of before. So
just fostering the environment to think in a way, to collaborate. And culture seems to be the most critical aspect of all of it.
And I think another thing that we haven't gotten to yet, but I see on the radar on the roadmap here is the whole issue of enlightening the people that are managing these innovators. Yep. So the you know, the project leaders and the project managers, creating the space for people to be able to improvise, let's say with Dynamo or Grasshopper or something on some aspect of a project, because they know it can solve some solution, you know, it can solve some kind of problem or enable some kind of exploration that wasn't possible otherwise. And for project managers not to get all nervous about a process that they're not familiar with. How do we empower our project managers to get comfortable with that, to allow innovation to happen on projects, you know, reasonable amounts of innovation, you know, that introduce reasonable amounts of risk. And then beyond that, if the development project is about something that leads to a new service or something that's client facing, training people how to sell this stuff is another big hurdle. People you know, that are typically out in front of our clients, you know, about our services, they're knowledgeable about the things that we've always done. They can get, you know, real uncomfortable trying to sell something they're not familiar with, even if it is really something powerful. So I think some focus on how do we address those people in the organization as well? How do we empower them? So
It's a very difficult, it's a, you know, in a way, like I asked a question, I'll ask you the same as, you know, kind of future of innovation or where you see things going. But I asked a guy a couple of weeks ago, the same thing. And he's like, well, I mean, we've always been innovating from day one, you know, I mean, from like the very beginning of how a wheel existed and everything, we're always innovating, but it seems now we're putting more focus on it. And corporations are recognizing that in a way, we've known if you don't evolve, you will probably perish. But now we really say, okay, we have to innovate. And so my ask, I guess, as we wrap up is, you know, how do you feel like everyone, we'll say specifically in architecture, since that's our domain, should everyone have an innovation program of some sort? Should anyone have a leader of innovation to really drive it as a process and not just be like this inherent thing that we say we do?
Yeah, I don't know if every firm is going to need a leader or not, or the leader may be the founder of the firm, and you know, the culture of a place, I think, is obviously the culture comes from the people. Yep. So depending on who the people are, that's going to sort of determine what your culture is. How far you can go in shifting the culture by virtue of hiring an innovation leader, I think is an open question. I don't know. I don't know. If it's just a matter of getting, you know, somehow unlocking the ability for people to innovate, you know, to access that latent innovation there that's just waiting to be given permission. Maybe that's how it goes. I'm not sure. But there's no question in my mind that yes, we've focused on innovation. I mean, design, it, you know, by virtue of the nature of design is innovation. I mean, we rarely are doing, you know, the same thing over and over again. You know, everything's yep. always a unique solution. And so you have to innovate, you know, at some level, no matter what. But now we're talking about it from a bit, you know, at a business model level almost. And, you know, as new kinds of startups, as the big technology companies are flexing their muscles by virtue of the data they have access to and the data processing capabilities that they have, the ability to do certain kinds of analysis that represent extremely high value propositions to our clients that have the ability, you know, to get in front of the clients even before they pull a trigger on a project and say, you may or may not actually even need to do this project.
You may not need another building. Let me yep. show you why.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and you know, we're seeing that, you know, from the technology companies, but also from the traditional consulting companies, you know, like the mm-hmm. Deloitte's and the KPMG's and the Accentures and those kinds of people are getting more and more into our space as well. So yeah, I think, you know, the preservation of our livelihood depends on us being aggressive about the way that we think about what we're delivering. So
absolutely. I read, and it was geared towards construction, but it's both, is we are prime for disruption. And the main reason is just most people in the industry. I mean, granted, there's some giant names that people never forget, but there's no IP. There's no nothing really that keeps the top dog that has the marketing power that keeps them in power. Yeah. They're just there by size or experience or longevity, but as a result, they're prime for disruption because really it just takes somebody with focus on technology or data or process or anything like that and can really upend a lot of these market leaders. So, I mean, I do think it's pretty critical to, we have to survive as an industry.
Yeah, I agree.
And this is the way to do it. Well, man, I've really enjoyed it. We could talk for a whole nother hour. You know?
Yeah, good stuff.
Thanks for listening to the AEC Disruptors podcast. Enjoyed this episode? Leave us a rating or review while sharing with your friends and coworkers. I'd love to hear from you. Send me a LinkedIn request or follow our LinkedIn page and let me know if there's a topic you'd like to hear. You can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening. The AEC Disruptors is directed by Christopher Riddell, produced by Todd Wyant, edited by Eric Daniel, and co-hosted by Jackson Sensat. The AEC Disruptors is an Applied Software production. Copyright Applied Software 2020.